That night we sat at a campfire together, away from the other officers, so that we could talk in private. We sat in silence for a while, looking up at the silver blaze of stars, and then Memnon said, "When I thought I had lost you, it was as though I had lost a part of myself. You are woven into my very first memory of life." I, who deal in words, could find no words to answer him. We were silent again, and then at last he laid a hand on my shoulder. "Did you ever see the girl again?" he asked. And though his tone was casual, his grip upon my shoulder was not. "Which girl?" I asked, to tease him. "The girl at the river, on the day we were parted." "Was there a girl?" I frowned as I tried to remember. "What did she look like?" "Her face was a dark lily, and her skin was the colour of wild honey. They called her Massara, and the memory of her still troubles my sleep." "Her name is Massara Benijon," I told him, "and I have spent 2 years imprisoned with her in the fortress of Adbar Seged. There I learned to love her, for her nature is even sweeter than her face." He seized me with both hands now and shook me without mercy. "Tell me about her, Tata. Tell me everything. Leave nothing out." So we sat the rest of that night beside the fire, and we talked about the girl. I told him how she had learned to speak Egyptian for his sake. I told him how his promise to her had sustained her through the dark, lonely days, and in the end I told him the message that she had sent to him, the message she had called out to me from the battlements of Adbar Seged as I rode away and left her. "Tell him I was brave. Tell him I love him." He was silent for a long while, staring into the flames, and then he said softly, "How can she love me? She does not know me." "Do you know her any better than she knows you?" I asked, and he shook his head. "Do you love her?" "Yes," he answered simply. "Then she loves you in the same way." I made her a promise. "Will you help me to make good my promise to her, Tata?" I have never in my life known such joy as was mine on my return to Kebui when I went aboard the Breath of Horus. Memnon had sent a messenger ahead to warn them of my return, and they were all waiting for me. "By the stinking crust between Seth's toes," Kratos shouted, "I thought we'd got rid of you at last, you old rogue." And he crushed me to his chest until I thought my ribs were all staved in. Thanos seized my shoulders and stared into my eyes for a moment before he grinned. "But for you, that hairy Ethiop would have had me. He got the better bargain when he took you instead. Thank you, old friend." I saw how Thanos had aged. Like me, there was grey in his hair now, and his face was weather-beaten, beginning to erode like a granite cliff. My little princesses were no longer little, but they were still adorable. They were shy towards me, for their memory of me had faded. They stared at me with big eyes as I made my obeisance. The colour of Bekata's hair had darkened to copper. I looked forward to rekindling her affection. Tahuti recognised me at last. "Tata," she said, "did you bring me a present?" "Yes, your highness," I replied. "I have brought you my heart." My mistress smiled at me as I walked towards her along the deck. She wore the light Nemes crown and the golden head of the cobra on her brow. When she smiled, I saw that she had lost her first tooth, and the gap marred her smile. She had thickened around the waist, and the heavy affairs of state had furrowed her brow and etched crow's feet at the corners of her eyes. To me, however, she was still the most lovely woman in the world. She stood up from the throne as I knelt before her. This was the highest mark of her favour. She laid her hand on my bowed head, and it was a caress. "You have been away from us too long, Taita," she said, so softly that only I could hear her. "Tonight you will sleep at the foot of my bed once more." That night, when she had drunk the bowl of herb broth that I had prepared for her, and I had covered her with a fur blanket, she murmured softly as she closed her eyes, "Can I trust you not to kiss me when I am asleep?" "No, Your Majesty," I replied, and stooped over her. She smiled as my lips touched hers. "Never leave us again for so long, Taita," she said. Memnon and I had planned our tactics meticulously, and we executed them with the same precision as one of our chariot manoeuvres. Thanos was easy to convince. His defeat by Akun still rankled. In his presence, Memnon and I discussed the ease with which the blue sword had sheared his bronze blade, and how Akun would certainly have killed him if I had not intervened. Thanos bristled with humiliation. Then Memnon questioned me on the magical origins and properties of the legendary weapon. Thanos forgot his pique and joined in with avid questions of his own. "This Prester Benny John has declared the blue sword a prize of war. Whoever can seize it may hold it," I told them. "If we went against Arkun, we would not be able to use chariots in those valleys," Memnon mused. "It would have to be the infantry. How do you think your Shilluk would fare against the Ethiops, Lord Thanos?" Memnon still addressed Thanos formally. Obviously he had not learned in my absence that Thanos was his real father. By the time we had finished with him, Thanos was as hot for the venture as either of us. He was totally in league with us as we started our campaign on Queen Lostris. From the very beginning, my mistress had understood, as Thanos never had, just how vital the horses and chariots would be if ever we were to fulfil the dream of the return to our very Egypt. I displayed the stallion that Prester Benny John had given me, and pointed out to my mistress his finer points of breed. "Look at his nostrils, Majesty. See the depth of his chest and the balance of muscle to bone. The Hyksos have nothing to match these Ethiopian horses." Then I reminded her of her promise to the dead pharaoh, and told her, "Prester Benny John will cede the valley of the tomb to you. His warriors will guard it against the grave robbers. He will place a taboo upon the valley, and these Ethiops are superstitious people. They will respect the prohibition even long after we have returned to Thebes." I warned Memnon not to mention to Queen Lostris his amorous interest in an expedition against Arkun. It would do our cause no good. Every mother is also a lover. She seldom takes any pleasure in seeing her son led away by another younger woman. No woman, not even a queen, could resist the combined charm and cunning of the three of us. Thanos and Memnon and myself. Queen Lostris gave her consent to our expeditionary force marching on Adbar Seged. We left the wagons and the chariots at the valley of Pharaoh's tomb and struck out into the mountains. Prester Benny John had sent a company of guides to meet us. They were 100 of his best and most reliable men. Thanos had selected a full division of his wild and bloodthirsty Shilluk and promised them all the cattle that they could capture. Each of these black pagans carried a cloak of thick jackal fur rolled upon his back, for we remembered the cold wind of the mountain passes. For support we had 3 companies of Egyptian archers led by Lord Kratos. That old ruffian had joined the company of nobles during my sojourn in Adbar Seged. He was spoiling for a real fight. He and every one of his men were armed with the new compound recurve bows that could outdrive the Ethiopian longbows by 200 paces. Memnon had selected a small band of the finest swordsmen and rough fighters that we had. Remran was one of these, of course, as were Lord Acre and Astes. I was part of this special detachment, not for my warlike skills, but simply because I was the only one who had ever entered the fortress of Adbar Seged. Huey wanted to come with us and offered me every bribe at his disposal. In the end, I gave in to him, mainly because I needed an expert to help me select the horses that Prester Benny John had promised me. I impressed on both Thanos and the prince how vital it was to move swiftly, not only for reasons of surprise, but also because the rains must soon break upon the mountains. During my days in Adbar Seged, I had studied the patterns of the weather and the seasons. If the rains caught us in the valleys, they would prove a more dangerous enemy than any Ethiop army. We made the approach march to Amba Kamara in less than a month. Our column wound through the passes like a long, deadly cobra. The bronze spearheads of the Shilluk glittered in the high sunlight like the scales of the serpent. We met no person to oppose us. The villages we passed through were deserted. The inhabitants had fled and taken their herds and their women with them. Although each day the clouds gathered black and sullen on the mountain peaks, and at night the thunder muttered at us, the rains held off and the fords of the rivers were low. 25 days after setting out, we stood in the valley below the massif of Amba Kamara and looked up the winding track to the heights looming over us. On my previous journeys up and down the mountain, I had studied the defences that Arkun had erected along the pathway. These comprised rock falls and stone-walled redoubts. I pointed these out to Thanos, and we could make out the bushy, unhelmeted heads of the defenders showing above the walls of the strong points. The weakness of a rockfall is that you can only let it come down once, and my Chinook are quick enough on their feet to dodge a charging buffalo, Tunnels said thoughtfully. He sent them up the path in small parties, and when the defenders knocked out the wedges from under the rockfall and sent it rolling down on the track, these long-legged black spearmen ran out to the side with the agility of mountain goats. Once the slide of boulders had rumbled past them, they turned straight up the almost sheer mountainside. Bounding from rock to rock and howling in such a horrible fashion that they started the hair on the nape of my neck, they drove the defenders up the mountain and over the crest. They were held up only by Akun's archers hidden behind the walls of the stone redoubts. When this happened, Kratos led his archers up the mountain. With their superior bow range, the Egyptians were able to stand back and shoot massed volleys almost straight into the sky. It was fascinating to watch a swarm of arrows climb into the air like a flock of black birds, and then drop down onto the redoubt so steeply the stone wall afforded the men behind it no protection. We heard their screams and then saw them break and scurry away up the slope. Immediately the Chinook were after them, baying like a pack of hunting dogs. Even from the bottom of the valley I could hear their battle cry, "Kajan! Kajan! Kill! Kill!" Though my legs were hard and my wind strong with so much marching, I had difficulty keeping up with Memnon and the rest of our small group. The years were beginning to take their toll. We were all wearing long woolen Ethiopic robes, and we carried the traditional round shields of our enemies. However, we had not yet placed the horsehair wigs on our heads. It would have been extremely unwise to resemble the Ethiopian too closely while the Chinook were in their present mood. When at last I came out on the flat tableland of the Amba, I saw at a glance that Tanus was rallying and regrouping his infantry. The one fault of the Chinook as fighting men is that once they have wet their spears with blood, they go berserk, and it is almost impossible to control them. Tanus was roaring like a bull elephant and laying about him with his golden whip of rank. Once more in hand, the Chinook formed ranks and moved forward against the first village where the Ethiopians were waiting behind the stone walls. As the wave of tall black figures, topped by a foam of white ostrich feather headdresses, washed towards them, they loosed a shower of arrows from their longbows. But the Chinook had their tall shields up. As the Chinook charge burst upon them, some of the Ethiopians rushed forward, brandishing their swords. They were not lacking in courage, but this type of warfare was new to them. They had never been forced to meet a charge that was carried through to the death. I stayed long enough to see them heavily engaged, and then I called to Memnon and his band, "The wigs!" Each of them pulled one of the wigs of black horsehair over his scalp. I had made these with my own hands, and styled them on the Ethiopian model of beauty, full and flockous. Clad in the long striped robes and with the wigs on our heads, we could pass as a mob of Akun's clansmen. "This way! Follow me!" I cried, and let out a ululating Ethiopic war cry. They yodeled and howled behind me as we skirted the village where the fight was still raging and ran in a disorderly bunch through the cornfields. We had to reach the fortress and be at Masara's side to protect her when Akun finally realized that he'd lost the day. I knew that he would not hesitate to kill her as soon as she was no longer of value to him. I thought that he would probably take the blue sword to her or throw her from the causeway into the gorge. Those were his favourite means of dispatching his victims. As we made our way across the Amba, we found the entire tableland in turmoil. Bands of bushy-headed warriors milled about in confusion. Women dragged their children by the arm, their possessions piled on their heads, wailing with terror as they ran about like frightened chickens who smell the fox. Herds of goats bleated and cattle lowed and churned the dust. The herd boys had fled. Nobody paid us the least attention as we trotted through the fields and kept clear of the villages. We followed the general movement towards Adbar Seged at the far end of the table, and as we neared the causeway the crowds thickened and congealed until we were obliged to force our way through them. There were guards at the head of the causeway. They were turning the fugitives back with drawn swords and clubs. Women were screaming and pleading for shelter in the fortress, holding up their babies for mercy's sake. Some of them were knocked down in the press and were trampled under the feet of those coming on from behind. "Form the tortoise," Memnon gave the order, and our small band closed up and locked the edges of our Ethiopian shields. We cut through the crowd like a shark through a shoal of sardines. Some of the weaker ones at the front were pushed forward and forced over the edge of the precipice. Their screams added to the panic. When we reached the head of the causeway, the guards there tried to stop us, but they were themselves so crowded by the mob that they could not swing their weapons and were in danger of being overwhelmed and thrown over the cliff. "We are under King Akun's direct orders. Stand aside," I shouted at them in Guise. "The password," the captain of the guard yelled at me, as he struggled to stay on his feet. The crowd surged back and forward in panic. "You must give the password." He poked his sword at me, but Memnon struck the blade aside.